Okay, so let me tell you first of all a little bit about Perimeter and what's different about it. You've got some impression already, probably. The way I would describe it is Perimeter is an attempt to really make an ecosystem for knowledge rather than a factory. Okay, and unfortunately, one of the problems in the world today is that educational and research institutions have become more modeled on a factory than on a sort of place of exchange of ideas and creation of new ideas. And I know you've all experienced high school, and you're all going on to university, and the modern trend is to crank out as many people as possible with degrees, and this has led to a sort of massification and factory mode of production. You all have to take lots of exams, and it must seem quite a burden a lot of the time. Perimeter's not like that. I don't think you've taken any exams. I hope you haven't taken any exams here. We understand and we believe that what we're after are new ideas, creativity, originality, and you don't get that by standardizing ideas or by rote learning. You get that by encouraging people to, guess what, think. So I hope you've been challenged and made to think and talk about your ideas even when they're not fully formed. That's all extremely valuable. So we're like an ecosystem, not a factory. And what does that mean? It means diversity is a big deal here. And diversity is a source of strength at Perimeter. Well, what do I mean by diversity? I mean that we have different points of view within the institute. It's not a single school of thought. At the moment, we have a very big gathering called IT from Qubit, which involves a lot of string theorists and quantum information theorists. That particular area represents one direction, point of view. There are many others within the institute, and basically everybody tries to keep each other honest and hold each other to account, right? So if you present some theory, you say, I'm going to explain X, Y, and Z, you will have a very critical audience saying, yeah, but we know that your starting point doesn't make any sense, and your theory hasn't given a correct prediction for 20 years, and all sorts of other questions. So that's very, very important, very healthy for people to question each other, question everything. So the first aspect of diversity is this diversity of ideas and approaches, because in that way you get a real competition of ideas, and rather than just assertions that our approach is the only one that's valid. And again, unfortunately, that is very common around the world, is that institutions tend to be dominated by one school of thought or other, and that's unhealthy. Second, of course, it's the international aspect of Perimeter and the gender aspect, of course. So physics is probably the worst of all fields. And theoretical physics is the worst of all fields, has been historically at encouraging women. It's no fault of the women. There were plenty of brilliant women who contributed to physics, but in general, physics represented the worst aspects of prejudice and the glass ceiling or whatever, blocking women from receiving the correct accolades or awards. And so we try to counter that. Equally important, the internationalism of Perimeter. I mean, you've probably got a little sense that Canada is a very international country anyway. Almost everyone here, apart from the small number of Aboriginal inhabitants, is an immigrant, comes from immigrant parents. And so this country is very, very international in perspective. Perimeter even more so. So we recognize that among the 7 billion people on the planet, the vast majority of those do not have access to advanced education or training. And that's a huge loss for the world, because many of those people may be very clever, very original, have great ideas. And in the past, when you look at the history of physics, many of the greatest discoveries were made by people from underprivileged backgrounds. In fact, you look at Einstein himself. I mean, he was a Jew, of course, and he came from Jewish heritage, and Jews were actually denied access to university education in Europe in the middle 19th century. It was only towards the end of the 19th century that Jews were allowed into university to take technical fields at all. And then in the early 20th century, when a number of Jews had received advanced training, they actually came in and revolutionized many fields. And that may well happen in the future. There are huge pools of untapped, blocked talent in the world that don't have access to opportunities like this one. And so I hope each of you will, you know, take that on board yourself and do whatever you can to encourage others. The other thing about Perimeter is that we try to avoid egos in this institute. It's not easy, because after all, especially in theoretical physics, you know, we have this model of the lonely genius, right, who makes the great breakthrough. And there's a lot of validity in that model. I mean, often the great discoveries do come down to one person. One person suddenly, aha, that's the way it works. Okay, whether it was Archimedes in his bath, or Dirac, who realized what the equation was that describes three quarters of the known particles. You know, often it does come down to an individual. But that doesn't mean that individual was in isolation. That individual had support from all kinds of directions, which enabled them to make that, to have that, lucky idea or insight. And so those of us who work at Perimeter feel value that our contribution to science can be as much in helping others to make discoveries as it is to make the discoveries ourselves. So we try to avoid a focus on, me, and instead think about a more collective approach that each of us is trying to contribute to the community of Perimeter and of theoretical physics in the world. And through those efforts, we can have at least as big an impact, and often greater impact, than in what we do as individuals. So all these sort of features of Perimeter distinguish it from many other centers, many other scientific centers. And actually, Perimeter is an experiment, even though it's in a theoretical subject. The whole thing is a big experiment. It came out of nowhere. It was initiated by somebody who made a lot of money by dint of hard work and a great idea. The smartphone, and then that person, Mike Lazaridis, was generous enough to say, you know, I don't actually need $100 million, and so I'm going to give this for founding a center devoted to theoretical physics. So it was an absolutely brilliant idea he had. He realized that nobody else was really doing things in the same way, and furthermore, he got the government to match his own gift. Provincial and federal government matched, and that this institute was born in a completely unknown place, okay, Waterloo, which I had not heard of until about 9 years ago. A great little town, but not widely known outside of Ontario. The creation of Perimeter was a very, very unusual thing. It actually unprecedented, I would say, in the history of theoretical physics, that something on this scale was created, recognizing the value of basic theory to society and trying to strategically develop the field. Okay, just hadn't happened before. So it's an amazing opportunity, and it's one we all have to make the most of. And I hope in your time here, you've begun to feel a little bit part of this experiment, you know, and what will success mean for this experiment? Well, success will mean breakthroughs. Right? That's what we're here for. We want major advances in our basic understanding of nature. Okay? It's an extremely ambitious goal. When you think of relativity, quantum mechanics, or the other great theories on Maxwell's theories, Newton's theories, great theories of physics, which have led to every single technology around us. Okay? It's that understanding that drives the technologies and that leads to or underpins progress in society. So what we're after is something on that scale. So it's an extremely ambitious goal. And very, you know, we'll see. 10 years from now, I want to look back and say, yeah, X was discovered at Perimeter, or through the efforts of Perimeter, helped by Perimeter in some way. I mean, that's what we have. So what's X going to be? Okay. And I just want to end with this. So the last 3 years, we have had more clues about fundamental physics than in the previous 30. Okay, so what big clues have we gained recently? What happened 3 years ago? Higgs boson. Yeah, excellent. So Higgs boson was discovered, predicted by Peter Higgs, who I met as a graduate student in Edinburgh, and a very interesting character. Probably the shyest person you could ever meet. He discovered it in the mid-1960s, the theory, the Higgs theory. He wrote a paper which is 1.5 pages long. I encourage you to look it up in Physical Review Letters. Amazing paper, 1.5 pages, very clear, makes one prediction. And he only made the prediction because the referee suggested, I'm not going to publish the paper, said, this paper should not be published because it makes no prediction. So Higgs replied and said, added a sentence to say, by the way, one of this theory predicts there should be a particle. Okay. Yeah, literally, that's what it was. And that theory turned out to be correct 50 years later in the greatest experiment of all time, the Large Hadron Collider. So it's an amazing example of the power of the human mind to see into the heart of nature. I mean, what was Higgs' clues? Higgs' clues were quantum mechanics, relativity, and then this spectrum of particles, which we see in nature. So those were all the clues. And he used those clues to infer there must exist something in the vacuum, right? The vacuum can't be empty. The vacuum, empty space, has a field in it called a Higgs field. And if you excite that field, if you make waves, like sound waves, in the Higgs field, those would be the Higgs boson, the Higgs particle. So incredible insight, 50 years ahead of its time, which resulted in the discovery 3 years ago. Okay, what happened 2 years ago? What was the greatest discovery in fundamental physics 2 years ago? I'm thinking big. Really big. What's the biggest thing you know? Yeah, very good. The Planck satellite. So the universe was mapped 2 years ago. This is an unbelievable thing. I mean, it's like in the last century, people basically finished mapping, not the last century, in the 19th century, end of 19th century, people finished mapping the Earth, the surface of the Earth, right? Just over 100 years ago. 2 years ago, we mapped everything. Everything visible. No, quite everything, actually. So everything visible to us using light. So the Planck satellite made a picture of the entire visible universe. And the discovery was amazing. The most amazing thing about it is the universe is stunningly simple. Right? On large scales, the structure of the universe is simpler than the structure of the hydrogen atom. It's really, really simple. It basically, Kendrick Smith has taught some of you about this. Actually, Kendrick is a very modest individual. Kendrick led the effort on the Planck satellite to characterize the fluctuations in the temperature of the universe as it came out of the Big Bang. And the discovery is that those fluctuations are unbelievably simple. You've probably heard of the normal distribution in statistics, right? So it's or Gaussian. So this is the sort of default that statisticians use. It's very common in many contexts. Usually it's wrong. Okay, you know, in finance or in biology, people always use the normal distribution, and almost always it's wrong, but it's a good, you know, rough guess. Well, in the universe, it's exact. Right? The fluctuations of the universe obey this Gaussian distribution to incredible accuracy. So the simplest possible distribution is what characterizes the variations in density and temperature that came out of the Big Bang, and that gave rise to galaxies and stars, and ultimately to people. And so Kendrick actually led that effort to characterize those fluctuations. And he found, to many people's great surprise, that these things are almost perfectly Gaussian. And this disproved a whole bunch of theories of the Big Bang, which was great. So by the way, your goal as a theoretical physicist is to disprove your theory as quickly as possible. Okay, that's what doing good science is about. It's not about promoting some theory and then sticking to it come what may. I mean, it's you should go after proving it wrong. And if you fail and fail and fail and fail, then it might be right. Okay, so what happened this year? Gravitational waves and black holes at the same time. Totally spectacular measurement made by the most sensitive measuring device ever created, the Advanced LIGO experiment. It can measure the length of the arms of the instrument, which there are two arms at right angles, and they're 4 kilometers long. And it can determine the length of those arms to an accuracy of 10 to the minus 21, okay, in length, which means 1/10,000th the size of an atomic nucleus, okay, is the actual length change they can measure using their laser interferometers. It's unbelievable that you can do this. What's even more unbelievable is that, as is currently understood, there really is no fundamental limit to the accuracy we could ultimately achieve in experiments like this. Okay, so people come here and they give talks about the latest ideas. There are many wonderful ideas for gravitational wave detectors. One of our faculty, Azimina Avanitaki, has proposed gravitational wave detectors which are about 10 meters long, very much smaller, and would use interference between atoms, quantum interference between atoms, instead of using light. Interference between light to measure the length of the instrument. And those could be just as accurate as LIGO and probably much cheaper. So there are lots and lots of wonderful ideas. And seemingly there is no limit to the accuracy that we can ultimately achieve in terms of measuring lengths, times, forces, I think we can, if you measure the strength of, it requires to push a key on your laptop, right? That's about a newton. And we can now measure forces to, I think it's 10 to the minus 17 newtons. Actually what's enabling all of this is quantum technologies. Quantum technologies seem to have this incredible, almost unlimited potential for making precision measurements. So yes, we saw black holes, we saw gravitational waves predicted by Einstein 100 years ago. And the amazing thing about those the experimental results is they were much, much better than anyone expected. We had the announcement in the bistro at Perimeter. It was made at the AAAS meeting in Washington. And you could have heard a pin drop. Okay. The graph went up, and it just lies bang on the theoretical prediction of Einstein's theory, with no fudge factors, no adjustment, exactly Einstein's equations as he invented them. Einstein wasn't even aware his equations described black holes. Right? And that took about 50 years for people to realize black holes were a consequence of Einstein's theory. So 100 years after this equation was discovered, it's confirmed in unbelievable accuracy, completely conclusive, undoubtedly going to win the Nobel Prize this year. This is the most obvious Nobel Prize in physics for decades. LIGO will win it. You heard it here. And the people who will win it are the most amazing experimental physicists, possibly one theorist, but the people who led this were experimentalists who in the 1960s began to design this super, super ambitious telescope. It took them, you know, almost 50 years to complete. And it's really a testimony to a huge team effort. And so I just want to end on this point. So we as humankind have discovered incredible things about the universe. They're pointing us in certain fascinating directions, which I think personally will lead to the next big breakthrough in physics. We're going to have a revolution on the scale of quantum physics and relativity. It may happen in the next 10 years or 20 years. Certainly we have amazing clues pointing us at the next big theory of physics, next unification. But something even more than that, from these discoveries, we should all draw optimism. Okay, the world faces a lot of problems. There's climate change, there's inequality, there's corruption, there are wars, there's terrorism, there's you name it, pollution, lots and lots of problems. But when you look at fundamental physics and theoretical physics, it tells you what human beings are capable of. We don't know why we're capable of understanding the whole universe. We don't know why we're capable of understanding what matter is made of and how it works. But we are. And that is just such a thrilling fact about life and our life in the universe. We need to share it. We need to share it with other people. We need to say, look, if we are rational and focused and logical, this is what we can do. And all the other problems the world faces can be solved. Of course they can. I mean, if you can build a detector with this accuracy, you know, solving the other sort of problems of the world should be straightforward. I feel that people in whatever they're working on, and all kinds of social and technical and other problems, should look at theoretical physics, physics in general, as an example of what can be done if people work together and do what we're capable of. So, okay, so that's all I want to say, and please ask any questions you'd like. I'm a cosmologist, by the way, but cosmology is everything, so I'm open to any question. Yes.
You mentioned in the beginning about the untapped potential of certain regions.
So yes.
I was specifically hoping to ask you about Ames, about
yes.
What the progress there has been since the last time you talked about in the green map of Africa.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Yeah, so I am. I was born in South Africa and spent my childhood in Africa, had my best ever teacher in Africa. And I was myself a teacher when I was 17 in a primary school in Africa. So basically when I became a professor at Cambridge, my parents leaned on me and they said, you better do something for your home, right? And I thought, what the hell can I do? Because I'm a cosmologist, you know, we're possibly the most useless species. you know, I'm not actually very good at practical things at all. And so the best I could come up with was to start a math institute, Mathematical Sciences Institute, which would serve the whole of Africa and take people from after undergrad education and sort of prepare them for research in any field of science which uses math or computing or any, you know, quantitative skills. So I had a chance to start this institute in South Africa. It's grown exponentially. The sixth center is opening next month in Rwanda. The Rwandan government has just signed an agreement committing $40 million to the growth of this center. It's a big operation. Last Saturday, I was chairing the board meeting in London of the AIMS initiative. And it's really a major, major organization now. We have just had our 1,200th graduate. So our graduates all graduate at master's level. About half of them continue to PhDs. You probably heard of the Ebola crisis in Africa. So one of our alumni was one of the key advisors to West African governments on how to tackle it. So somebody with a mathematical background, from Cameroon, from a very, very poor family. He came to Ames, he did his PhD in Cambridge. He's now a professor at Yale. And he's a specialist in tropical diseases and mathematical modeling of tropical diseases. And he played a very big and very positive role in advising West African governments how to tackle Ebola. So we're very, very proud of him. And there are a whole number of alumni like this. They've gone into IT and microfinance. They've gone into energy and water. Many of them are heads of departments in African universities. And you get an energy in Africa, which, and I'm biased, which is unequaled anywhere. Okay, Africa is coming. And I personally believe there will be a wave of young Africans in the next 10, 20 years who are going to go into all fields. President Obama is one of them. But we're going to see many more. By 2050, one in three of the young people in the world, the people under 21, will be African. Okay, so if they don't receive education and opportunities, it's going to be a very big problem for the world. On the contrary, if they do, and I prefer to look at it positively, if they do, they will be the new generation coming in and making great advances in everything. So yeah, AIMS has progressed incredibly well. And I would say this to you. I mean, in my case, I had no idea what I could do. All right? I thought, you know, I'm a straight physicist. I worked with Stephen Hawking. I'm trying to develop ridiculously ambitious theories of everything. I'm not a practical guy. But due to my background, my family, and what happened in my home, I realized I can do, you know, I have to do something, actually. Even though I'm not equipped to do it, I have to do something. That's what is needed now. And I went to do it, and I learned how to write a business plan, how to make a case to a funder, how to bring people together to work for a common goal. All these things, right? Management. Management was a nightmare to me. I had no interest in management at all, okay? But you know, the best managers are the people who don't want to be managers, okay? Because they actually want to do something. They're not just managers. They were doing it for a purpose. So I discovered I could do these things. And they're really not that difficult. Certainly compared to solving the Big Bang, this is easy. All right, so I think all of you should realize, all of you are here in this classroom should realize, A, it's great you are choosing to grow your mind in the most difficult area of science. Okay, have no illusions. This is the hardest area of science. That's great. Aim high. It's brilliant. Even though the chances of you're actually making the big breakthrough are tiny, right? I still hope you do. But it doesn't matter if you do or you don't. You will have wonderful fun trying. But the second thing you should realize is with the capabilities you have and with the way in which you're growing your minds, there's a million things you can do, right? And if you turn your attention to those and you decide, look, this is really important, I want to do this, you can do phenomenal things. I discovered I could do all kinds of things I didn't believe I could do. I had no skills, no training. You can all do the same. Okay, so AIMS is an amazing example of something that came out of nothing. In fact, the reason it succeeded is because it was different than anything else that existed. It's when I started, I said, I don't want to start a university. Who needs another university? There were already 600 universities in Africa. They're providing, in general, quite, you know, well, I won't be too negative, but I could be quite negative. Okay, they were isolated. The graduates weren't really equipped to do things. Full of rote learning. You know, much of it understandable because they're badly funded and so on. So I didn't want to create the 601th university. I wanted to do something very, very different. And so again, encourage you, think different. Don't copy what there is. Don't think you have to replicate. There's so many opportunities to do innovative things. That's what innovation really means. It's a horrible buzzword, but there's a very strong element of truth in it. That when you really innovate, amazing things can happen. It's another example of how much more we can do than we are aware of. Most people feel squashed by society and, you know, where they are and expectations and all that stuff. You have to just throw all that away and say, no, what's actually important? What do I really want to do? And I can talk for a long time about that. Anyway, any other questions? Yes?
What inspired you to be like a cosmologist? Like,
It's a good question. I never wanted to be a cosmologist. I thought biology is so much more interesting than physics. It really is. I still believe that. Okay? There is, in my opinion, nothing more interesting than life. It's totally bizarre. At some level, it violates all known laws of physics. Life organizes itself. Right? Entropy does not increase. Of course, the total entropy does increase. But the life in replicating and doing what it does is basically a miracle from a physics point of view. You know, a physicist would never have predicted the origin of life, but it happened. So it shows us how incomplete physics is. When I was a child, I collected insects. And I was in Tanzania, where Anwesh is from. And we lived there for 3.5 years because my dad and mum were refugees from South Africa. They were politically involved. Both went to prison. That's another story. But I landed in Tanzania and surrounded by the most amazing bugs and creatures. So I spent all my time collecting bugs and insects and still think, you know, if you want beauty, there's nothing more beautiful for me than nature. And even the tiniest bug is just an unbelievable thing, especially when you realize it seems to have emerged out of randomness. So I wanted to do biology. I was good at maths. I wanted to do mathematical biology. I went to university at Cambridge, determined to do mathematical biology. And maybe I should have. But after a year of it, I realized that the error bars in biology are astronomical. Okay. The models do not fit the data to better than plus or minus 100%. Okay. It's just a fact of life. Biology is really, really complicated and difficult. Now, there's been a lot of progress. There's genetic sequencing, which is fantastic, and all of that. But it's nevertheless true that there are no powerful mathematical concepts in biology or, for that matter, any other field with the level of precision of physics. There's just nothing that compares with Einstein's equation or Dirac's equation or Maxwell's equation. And that's spooky. I mean, that's what's spooky about physics, is that somehow you can figure out how things work. And boy, does it work. You know, it's incredible the how powerful that knowledge is. And so physics really underpins all the other fields. I mean, my definition of physics is the application of mathematics to reality. But, okay, it's not mathematics. Okay, the reality part of it is very, very important. If mathematics works in describing reality, we call it physics. Okay, that's what physics is. It's when math works in describing reality, that's what physics is. So for that reason, when people use maths in other areas, like financial maths, it's not physics. Why? Well, basically because it doesn't work. Okay. So, you know, it's a bit of a biased perspective, but I think the fact that Higgs worked, Einstein worked, you know, the Maxwell works at extraordinary levels of universality and accuracy is something which helps every other science. And ultimately, I hope we will go back to, you know, we will make progress on understanding what life is or what consciousness is, who we are. We have no idea who we are. You know, really, we have no idea how we work. And there are kind of clues from physics, quantum physics, that the observer seems awfully important in quantum physics. You know, you make an observation and it changes the state of a system. We're still trying to get to grips with that. Maybe that is the seed of some knowledge about who we are and what role we play in the universe. It's a deep mystery for the moment. Yeah, any other questions? Yes?
It's not a physics question, but kind of related to physics.
Yes.
Which college do you recommend to study theoretical physics? Cambridge?
No. No, I'm only joking. Cambridge or?
Imperial College of London.
All right. Well, I was in both places. I did my PhD at Imperial College, and then I got my undergrad at Cambridge, and then I went back to be a professor there. Why do you choose those? Why is that the only choice? There's a whole world out there.
Because I know you have studied in this
two
college, and it's also my choice.
Oh, I see. Okay. Both they have different pluses and minuses.
Can you introduce them?
Well, you know, I don't want to be too specific, and especially because I'm being recorded. And I have a lot of friends at both places. They're very different. Imperial College, much younger. That has lots of advantages. It has an incredible tradition. Abdus Salam was there, who invented electroweak theory, and Tom Kibble, who almost got the Nobel Prize with Higgs, so I worked with Kibble when I was at Imperial. Unfortunately, he just passed away recently. Very simplistic point of view, Imperial would be younger, maybe more open environment. Cambridge would be somewhat more traditional. Lots of fantastic people there. It's a difficult decision, both very good places. I think when, you know, somebody gave me advice when I was thinking about where to do my undergrad, And I was a bit of a radical, okay, and so I wouldn't go near Oxford or Cambridge, and I want to go to Sussex. Sussex was where the young hippies went, and I thought I'm going to Sussex. So my dad, who is a kind of real radical political activist, he said, wait, just wait. Let me get you to talk to somebody. So he called a friend of his who's a physicist, And I had a phone call with this guy. This guy said, you know, I understand Cambridge is a snobby place and blah, blah, blah. But if you miss this opportunity, right, you will regret it later. And even though you may not be attuned to the institution, you can still get a lot out of being there. Okay. So he basically talked me into it, and I went to Cambridge reluctantly. And indeed, there were things that really annoyed me, I have to say. The elitism, the smugness of Cambridge colleges and all that. I'm not a fan of that. But you may like it. It's up to you. but the intellectual environment was certainly very, very good. I had amazing lecturers at Cambridge. So one of the, I don't know if it's still true. Probably not. But when I did physics at Cambridge, no lecturer would recommend a textbook on principle. They would just say, oh, no textbook is possibly good enough for my course. Okay. So, and actually that was great. I went to the lectures and they said, look, we're going to give you 50-minute lectures. This is all you need to know, all, right? So if you can understand that 50 minutes, you can become a master of that field. Okay, so you, so the terms were 8 weeks, very nice and short. So half of the year you are on holiday, two 8 week terms and 1 4 week term. So only 20 weeks of the year you're actually in class. All right, and the rest of the time you're trying to make sense of these 50 minute lectures, right, which are very good. And this was just perfect for me. It was great. I didn't want to spend all my time listening to lots and lots of lectures. I wanted a crystal clear introduction and then time to think about it on my own. So there was that style of teaching, which was really, really good. Very respectful of the students. And so it suited me very well. Now, things have probably changed since that time, because the numbers of students have grown, and lecture classes have grown, and so on. And it's become more of a machine. Okay, so I think, you know, all of you, you're facing difficult choices, where to go, what to do. You know, the one thing I would say to each one of you is hold on to yourself. Don't let the institution grind you down. Okay. Don't feel you must conform. You must anti-conform. You must do your own thing. Think for yourself, you know. Don't accept their way of grading you, of judging you, of whatever. They probably have it wrong. Okay? That's the best I can say. Yep. Go ahead.
Similarly to how you talked about your father's friend you to go to Cambridge.
Yes.
Can you attribute one person in your life who had the greatest influence on you, like a mentor or somebody?
Yes. Yes, it was my primary school teacher when I was 8 years old. She was Scottish, volunteer teacher in Africa. It's not like she was particularly brilliant mathematician or anything, but she just encouraged me to play. Okay, so she encouraged me to do projects. I didn't do much classwork. So for example, it was very funny. I mean, and she was influenced by the Scottish tradition, which is very strong. And that's, by the way, where Maxwell came from. You know, why was Maxwell this mathematical genius? If you trace it back, it goes back to 18th century Scotland. In Scotland, in I think 1705, the government in Scotland decided that every village in Scotland would have its own government-funded primary school. A school, not even primary school, government-funded school. Every town, village in Scotland. So I think they made 300 schools in one go. And there was this emphasis on public education. Okay. And then in Scottish universities, by the way, Scotland had 4 universities in the 18th century, whereas England only had 2, Oxford and Cambridge. So these 4 Scottish universities created this amazing intellectual environment. It hugely outshone England. where philosophers and writers and all kinds of creative people came, and Maxwell was sort of came out of that environment, as did my school teacher ultimately. So they had this very clear notion that public education was about fundamental concepts. Okay, so when you thought about space or geometry, you spent a lot of time thinking, what is space after all? You know, what is geometry? Does it exist? Is mathematics a picture of reality, or does it exist in a different realm? What is it? We spent a lot of time thinking about very fundamental aspects. We did set theory, you know, what are sets? What are numbers? We did all that at primary school. And so sort of chores like multiplication or division or addition, you know, we just came afterwards and say, yeah, okay, something you have to do, but not particularly exciting. And then I went to England when I was 9 years old. And in England, it was totally different. They gave you a big sheet with about 100 multiplications and long divisions that you had to do. And they gave you this thing, and you're supposed to sit there for an hour doing all these multiplications. I said, you can't be serious. Once you know how to multiply, you know you don't need to keep doing it again and again. Come on. And so I just thought that was ridiculous. I mean, I had been doing multiplications in base 2 and in binary and, you know, in different number bases. And, yeah, that was fun. I'm not going to do lots of long multiplications. So it was really boring to get to England. And what's so great is that I had this wonderful teacher in Tanzania, you know, which some people think of as a backwater, but in fact it was much better than what I ever had later. So yeah, I think teachers are incredibly important, and especially very when people are very young. Yeah.
Would you say like how good the undergraduate program at Pembroke's, like how good is the undergraduate program here for like studying mathematics or?
We don't have one.
Oh, really?
No.
that's a summer program.
Oh, so, oh my bad.
It's okay. No, we do have undergraduates come for a summer, and they can work with, usually with postdocs, on a project. We only have very few per year, so between 5 and 10. And basically, they come and hang out and work on some research project. We don't have an undergraduate program. Yeah, yeah.
Well, then kind of going off what he said, how do you think the graduate program here compares to other universities? You seem to have a very fundamentally different approach.
Yes, 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 yes. I think I've explained.
Okay.
Yeah. there's no comparison. Yeah.
You talk about getting like not being ground down by your education. And
yes.
I feel like there's so much competition at universities
that
often lose sight of what you're actually learning.
Yes.
So do you think it would be better to go to a more intimate, less competitive university for undergrad rather than going to one of the bigger ones and feeling lost in a sea of kind of...
It's up to you. It's totally up to you. I would say everything in the end must be driven by you. What feels right for you. When you start giving into the system, it never ends. Okay, so I encourage everybody to stick up for yourself and don't. I know this very well. My daughter has just finished her undergrad, and I know very well what kind of problems are undergraduates face, which is huge pressure, competition, all sorts of silly expectations that people have, and they sort of use your success to build their own reputations. There's a lot of bad stuff going on at universities today. And I think it's all in the wrong spirit. I mean, knowledge is this wonderful, wonderful thing which we should all share. You don't have to be the next genius, the next Einstein or whatever to appreciate the beauty and the wonder of this knowledge, and to help other people, you know, and to a large extent, who makes the discoveries is random. It's a random thing, you know. So putting all the stuff on the shoulders of each individual student to say, you know, you must be successful, especially when it's about grades. I mean, honestly, who gives a damn about grades? At the end of the day, you know, I can tell you 30% of the students at Cambridge get first-class degrees. That's it. It's legislated. So does it mean much? Well, it means they worked hard and, yeah, at some level they can do stuff. But does it really equip them for thinking about the world and its problems? Not at all. I mean, it's mental exercise. Okay. It has good aspects, but there are also lots of bad aspects. The standardization of ideas and so on has a lot of terrible consequences. At the back, yeah.
Many of the physicists that I've talked to during these past weeks have underlined the importance of finding a mentor.
Yes.
What would you say, what would you recommend that we do when trying to find a mentor?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's all so random. you know, when I look at my example, the people who ended up being my mentors were just happened by accident. So I don't know, too many to mention in detail, but one example, I had a PhD advisor. And when I started my PhD, I assumed he was an absolutely brilliant person. And I assumed that the advice he was giving me was the best advice. So he said, work on this, gave me a problem, I worked on it, I nearly killed myself trying to solve it. It's a very difficult problem. Took me about a year, I made some progress, went back to him, said, yeah, I've made some progress. He said, yeah, well, that's not very interesting. It wasn't such an important problem. And so in the meantime, I was quite frustrated. And I went to another professor, who was Tom Kibble, who was a co-inventor of the Higgs mechanism, elaborated the Higgs mechanism in a very important way. Strange individual, unbelievably brilliant person, who slept a lot of the time. Okay. So quite hard to wake him up and say. So I went to him and I said, you know, wake up, I've got a problem. So he said, okay, well, why don't you read this paper? So I went away and I worked 24 hours that weekend. I had a weekend and I came back to him Monday morning and I said, yeah, I've solved that problem. And he looked at it and he said, okay, I'll look at it. He looked at it, came back and said, no, you're wrong. He made a mistake. I thought, oh. So then I checked what he'd done, and I found that he'd made a mistake. And actually what I'd done was right. So I went back, and then we wrote a paper together. And so that happened in 2 days. You see, I spent a year banging my head against the wall on a really difficult but ultimately uninteresting problem. And then in 2 days, something, you know, amazing happened. And so that's what theoretical physics is, even more like that than life. I mean, life is pretty random, okay? Theoretical physics is like the most random thing. So how do you make the most of it? Well, don't let it get you down. You know, 99% of what you do will fail or be wrong. You've got to be open to interactions. You've got to keep trying. And then these random things will happen. Our job is to promote the randomness. Okay. But it's really true that in physics, if you talk with someone from a totally different background or perspective, often something very fruitful will happen. In fact, there's no better example than young people. When young people come and talk to me or any other physicist in perimeter, they'll ask questions. What about this? What about that? And sometimes those questions won't be the ones we've thought of. We'll say, ah, that's a good question. I hadn't thought of that. And then that leads somewhere. So young people bring energy. And that's what you've got right now. You know, you've got energy. You've got enthusiasm. These are huge assets. You know, in fact, this is what I always say to people. The most precious thing you hold is your enthusiasm. Right? You lose that, forget it. You may as well go and do something else. So you've got to protect that enthusiasm. Don't make yourself do something you don't want to do, right? Just don't do it, because you will turn off your enthusiasm. And when the enthusiasm's gone, you won't do anything anyway. So nurture it, look after yourselves, eat well, you know, except when you see something really special that you want to plunge into, and then something good might happen. So yeah, I'd say promote randomness, keep your enthusiasm, and yeah, don't let the institutions grind you down. Yeah.
Have you thought about starting an undergraduate program at Perimeter?
Yes, but you see, at Perimeter, we don't want to do anything which anyone else is doing or could do better. Everything we do here, we want to be the best. And we want it to be original. Could we have undergraduates here? Yeah, it might be a good idea, but how many? We've thought about starting a high school, actually. For several years, I thought about starting a high school. See, when you start something new, and I've had the good fortune to start several new things, right, from scratch. When you start something new, the first thing you have to realize is all of the obstacles which are in the way. And amazingly, 99% of those obstacles are bureaucratic or, you know, due to bureaucratic or competitive. So there will be other institutions which will be really upset. So I guarantee you, if Perimeter started an undergraduate program, all the other universities in Canada would be really upset with us. And then there would be all sorts of issues at the ministry, and you know, how do you get around all the legalities? And so all the obstacles come in this way, in through what's there already. Okay, so somehow the best way to succeed is to go into a niche in which there's nothing. Okay. Then you have this free space. So because nobody ever thought of making an institute whose focus was quantum theory and space-time, no one ever thought of that in the history of physics. Right? That's what Perimeter did. It went into that area. Everyone else said, oh, that's way too ambitious. It'll never succeed. You know, and also, it's in Canada, in some small town in Canada. Who cares? And so they left it alone. And they didn't try to block it. That's why it succeeded. And it was the same with AIMS. We went to Africa. We said, OK, there are lots of undergrad universities. There are some PhD programs. We'll just go in the middle. So we're not directly competing. And we can tell both of them, we're going to strengthen you. If we succeed, it will help you. Right? So don't block us. Okay? Because, yeah, and so that's really, really important. So, but the biggest lesson is don't copy. I mean, if you say, why don't we start an undergraduate program? I look at all the undergraduate programs. Do I want to copy that? No. You know, you do something original. There are plenty of undergraduate. I have a lot of criticisms of undergraduate programs, but there are some good ones. Where are you?
Sorry.
Where are you at? Oh, sorry, you high school. Where are you applying to for undergrad?
I don't know. Perhaps University
of Toronto. Toronto, U of T. Yeah, very good. No, universities are. I don't want to be negative about universities. Universities are wonderful. In my view, the university is the greatest invention humankind ever made. Right? Just the idea of a place where people go to share ideas. It's a wonderful, wonderful idea. And it's the most fruitful thing you can do. But universities become, you know, places where departments compete with each other, and the bureaucracy blocks progress, and the institution becomes self-serving, right? They say, what's your goal? Well, to make us higher on the league table. You know, it's pathetic. It's just pathetic. In the long scheme of history, who cares about the league table of universities? I mean, it's just irrelevant. So, as I say, I think use those institutions for all they're worth, see the good parts, benefit from the good people there, and try to ignore all the other, you know, painful stuff that comes along with them. Yeah?
Several people throughout the last week and a half told me that
told us to ask you about your thoughts on inflation.
Yes. Well, that's a great lead-in. It's not just inflation. So I am a bit of a radical in physics, I have to warn you. And so everything I take should be, I say should be taken with a grain of salt. Of course, everything everyone else says should be taken with a mountain of salt. Okay. But for the last 30 years, theoretical physics has gone off in all kinds of directions which I think one should question. Okay, and I include myself in those. Okay, so when inflation is one of those directions, string theory is another one. There are big bandwagon fields in theoretical physics, which if you ask any kind of critical question, i.e., what is your successful prediction? You know, is this really a theory on the level of Maxwell or Einstein or Dirac? You know, is it a part of that tradition? Or is it something very contrived and complicated where you introduce lots of assumptions and parameters, more like what people do in other fields, right? Okay, which is it? And I think any rational person would say that these big bandwagon fields do not yet deserve to be considered as part of the, you know, real theoretical physics. So if we talk about inflation in particular, so I came across this when I was, inflation was invented when I was doing my PhD. And I actually went to the first workshop on inflation. And it didn't impress me at all. I mean, I just had the feeling these guys are just making it up as they go along. No matter what the observation, they'll adjust the theory to fit the data. And I basically keep to that point of view. I mean, it's one of the most successful theories in science in terms of the number of papers, citations, conferences, workshops. And a large reason for that is it's a very, very adjustable theory. Okay, so it doesn't, it's a very unprincipled theory. It doesn't have a principle which says, you know, the mathematical laws need to follow this principle, and instead inflation is a sort of scenario. In fact, the first paper on inflation was called the Inflationary Universe Scenario. And it hasn't got beyond that point. It's still a scenario, which could include thousands of different models and all kinds of predictions and so on and so on. So it's a very broad church, and this is a big reason for its success. You see, in science today, you can, if you join one of these broad churches, you can publish lots of papers. And the referees are other people in the broad church, and they will accept your papers, and you'll accept theirs, and it's a very nice game. Everybody publishes thousands of papers. But you know, I'm afraid I am interested in finding the truth. I'm not actually interested in all those paraphernalia of science, publications, conferences, blah, blah, blah. No, I mean, I actually want to find the truth. Is inflation the truth? In my view, unlikely. Too contrived. It's trying to explain how the universe got so big. Kendrick must have told some of you about inflation, did they? Did he? Not. Okay, I won't go on about inflation much. Just to say it's a theory trying to explain why the universe got so big and so smooth. What has happened is that the observations of the universe have revealed that it is much simpler than any inflation model would lead you to believe. There are thousands of models. They can predict or explain almost anything in the universe. And yet what we find is this stunning, stunning simplicity, okay, in the structure of the universe. So basically, I need one number to describe the large-scale structure of the universe. Just one. It's the level of density fluctuations. They're the same on every scale, the same level on every scale, and they have an overall level, which is about 10 to the minus 5. That number explains the structure of the universe on large scales. It's a small correction, which is that the fluctuations get a little bit bigger at larger scales, but it's a, 5% correction. Sorry, 3% correction. So the universe is stunningly simple, whereas this large school of inflation models could actually fit all kinds of universes. And that theory has sort of self-destructed, in my view, because it led to the notion of a multiverse. Right? So the multiverse, in my opinion, is one of the worst ideas science ever came up with. It's not original. Many people have had this a long, long time ago, that there are different places in which the universe would look completely different. Okay? And we can't see those places. So this idea is amazingly popular. And essentially because of the failure of theories like string theory to really predict the universe we see, people have said, oh, well, maybe there's a multiverse. So the string theory fits all of these universes, and it just happens we're in this one. I don't find that particularly satisfying, and I'm really surprised at people taking this seriously. So it's not just inflation. It's I would say, most of what happens in theoretical physics today is unconvincing. Okay, and I could be very pessimistic about that, say, oh, this field's going nowhere. I'm not. I think the field is getting more and more into a crisis where the contrast between the beauty and simplicity in nature and the ugliness of our theories is getting more and more striking. We saw this last year. So last year, February, I believe, the BICEP 2 experiment claimed to see the smoking gun of inflation. And Stephen Hawking, my friend, who I worked with at Cambridge, claimed on BBC radio that he had won his bet with me. And so I went on the radio with him, and I said, oh no, I'm sorry, you haven't won your bet, because in science, you have to repeat an experiment. We know that you never believe an experimental result unless it's been replicated by an independent team. Secondly, when you looked at that experiment, there were at least 5 screaming errors in the paper, okay, which theorists, by the way, had largely ignored just because they wanted the result to be right. This last 30 years, unfortunately, has seen theorists separate off from reality to a large extent. And it's kind of a tragedy. I mean, it's partly because the theories are so complicated, you need a lot of math, so understandable reasons. And partly because the experiments are so difficult, it takes such a long time. But so this has happened, and those theorists who jumped on the bandwagon and said, yeah, this is right, we've confirmed inflation, were just revealing the fact that they really didn't have a good grasp of the meaning of those experiments. And so Stephen wanted, I'd had a bet with him 10 years earlier, and he's not very good on bets, as you may have gathered. So I took a bet with him in 2001, when our model, the cyclic model, predicted 0 gravitational waves from the beginning of the universe, effectively 0. It's a very small level, but unmeasurably small. And he challenged me. He said, I bet you it's observed. Okay, so I said, okay, I'll take the bet for any sum of money you wish to name. Okay. And he wouldn't name the amount. And it just kept going and kept going. Every time I saw him, Stephen, how much? You know, what are we going to do for a bet? And finally, BICEP happened. And he had just lost $100 on the Higgs boson, because he bet it wouldn't be there. Okay, in the 1970s, on rather deep theoretical arguments, which turned out to be wrong, but to do with loss of information in black holes. So he bet there would be no Higgs boson. So he just lost the bet. So he said, this is much more important, so you have to pay me $200. And he put in brackets Canadian, because he has a very good sense of humor. Okay. And so I said, no, I'm not paying you 200, but I said, I accept the bet for 200, but we'll change the terms. So number one, there's got to be a repeat. Number two, if the signal goes, so they were claiming 20% gravitational wave signal. I said, I didn't believe it for a minute. And if the signal, I said, I will pay you $200 as long as the signal is anywhere above 5%, okay, from any experiment. And so he accepted the bet, so that's the formal bet. Right now, the limit is 7%. And within the next 6 months, 1 year, it's going to fall below 5%, and I'm going to get my $200 Canadian. I'm quite confident about that. But you know, what makes me confident? I mean, so this inflation theory has some simple versions. It all depends on an arbitrary function, which you're free to invent. That's why I don't like the theory. And so it's called V of phi. This is some field which drives inflation. And the simplest case, you know, V would be, this would be V of phi going like phi squared. And so that was sort of the first out of the box model of inflation. Amazingly, that theory is ruled out now, observationally. It's dead. And so the next theory would be phi to the fourth, which is sort of flatter here. And this is also ruled out. So what people are doing now is they are bending this guy and managing to survive by taking phi squared here, and then they bend it at larger phis, and you introduce more parameters, and you know, it's not really a theory anymore. But so I think that's all great. Observations are pushing these theories, so-called theories, into a corner where they become more and more contrived. And because more and more obvious, this is not the right explanation. Okay. So I believe that's what will happen. Someone who hasn't asked. Yes?
Do you think that the complexities of our current theories like string theory, do you think that arrives as a result of a more advanced understanding of the universe? Or because
no.
Our thinking has shifted away from, I guess, simpler or more fundamental?
Yes. I mean, there's a very similar situation in 19th century. So 19th century, people thought they'd solved all of physics. There was classical mechanics. There was electromagnetism. They seemed to explain pretty much everything, right? There were a few little details, like what is an atom, actually? How does an atom work? They didn't quite know that, but they had various models. So they were building mechanical models of nature. Right? That's what was happening in 19th century physics. And very, very successful, incredibly successful theories. But so imagine I'm trying to build a model of a hydrogen atom. You know, I've got this electron going around the nucleus. Well, if I knew that much, right? They later learned from Rutherford that an atom is a nucleus with an electron going around. Now you say, okay, I'm going to use electromagnetism and some other laws to describe it. And the first thing you find is this catastrophe that you know, the electron will spiral into the nucleus and radiate away its energy in electromagnetic waves. And so you just can't make a model. So you have got two options. Either you say, okay, well, I'll put a spring in there, right, to stop the electron falling in. I'll put a spring there, you know, or I'll, you know, invent some other force or some other field, or, you know, I'll just elaborate the models we have already. And, you know, some people did that, and it was a total failure. The alternative to say, maybe we've got the whole thing wrong. Okay. Maybe energy is quantized. Okay. Maybe there's a quanta of something. And so this is a totally radical idea, came absolutely from left field, was forced on physics by certain contradictions. And that's where we learned, and that's where the progress came from. So let's look at today. Well, we have contradictions every bit as big as drove quantum mechanics. The whole universe came out of a singularity. If that isn't a contradiction, I don't know what is. I mean, everything came out of a point, a mathematical point. Okay. So what do you say about that? Well, what I say is, wow, what a clue. You know, what a clue to the new physics. Can we make sense of that amazing statement that within our current theories, all of the whole universe came out of a point? So I find it absolutely fascinating. I want to study it. I want to see what kind of theory might be able to make sense of that? So we have a recent paper about this called A Perfect Bounce, where we use quantum mechanics to describe how the universe can go through a point. But we don't just introduce more bells and whistles into the laws of physics to try to solve this incredible problem. A similar clue is the dark energy, the vacuum energy, right? So we've learned in the last 15 years that empty space is not empty, it's full of energy. It has positive energy density. In fact, 70% of the energy in the universe is in this stuff, which fills all the space. And it is in many ways the simplest form of energy because it has no structure. It's exactly the same in space, in time, it doesn't change. What is it? It's something to do with quantum mechanics. We know that because we know that every field in the universe, like the Higgs field or electromagnetic field, contributes to the vacuum energy. And somehow all of these contributions add up to give us this vacuum energy we see. And we also know that all of our current theories are absolutely hopeless at predicting the number. Whether it's string theory or quantum field theory, they all get the number wrong by approximately 10 to the power 120. That's a big error. So this is a huge, huge clue that we are missing some fundamental principle of physics. And there are many other clues. There are all kinds of coincidences in the universe. That, you know, the dark energy took over the universe around the same time that galaxies were forming. Why did that happen at the same time? Why is the dark matter similar in density to the dark energy? When they, as the universe expands, the dark energy stays constant, but the dark matter dilutes away. But they happen to be nearly the same today. Dark energy, dark matter is 25%. Why is that true? There are all these funny coincidences. These are clues that we're missing something really important. And so string theory, what is string theory? String theory is basically an elaboration of the theory of quantum fields, which dominated 20th century physics. String theory is just taking that further. It uses those principles. It doesn't really bring any new fundamental principles. You use quantum mechanics and relativity, you more or less uniquely get to string theory. And then the worst thing is that string theory has just exploded into this unpredictive multiverse theory. So string theory says there are 7 unobserved dimensions of space. They can be arranged in an infinite variety of ways. There are all kinds of fields which can or cannot be twisted around these dimensions. So the whole thing has just become a sort of theorist's nightmare. And some people embrace that and say, great, we have more theories than we expected. They can fit anything. People like me want to be guided by nature. Nature is telling us it is incredibly, incredibly simple. Another example, the Large Hadron Collider. Most theorists in the world were predicting, most particle physicists were predicting that the Large Hadron Collider would discover supersymmetry, meaning double the number of particles that we see. Okay? So far, they've all been proven wrong. It found the Higgs boson and nothing else. Nature chose the simplest option. We don't know how nature got away with it. Okay? But for me, these are very profound clues, and I don't see string theory bringing ideas of the type we will need to resolve these problems. We need very new ideas, which really tackle the problems. It's really interesting. So the Big Bang singularity, I have tried for 10 years to get string theorists interested in using string theory to study that problem. In general, they say, oh, no, it's too hard. I can't do that. But unfortunately, that is the problem. And if you don't study that, I don't think you're going to learn much new about physics. I went to a lecture when I was a graduate student by Paul Dirac. Now, Paul Dirac invented the equation that describes 3/4 of the known particles, all the fermions. And he basically talked for an hour about the number 137. 1/137 is the fine structure constant. Okay, so it's a dimensionless number that tells you how strong the interaction, electromagnetic interactions are between electrons and protons. So it's a dimensionless number, very important. It's not exactly 137, it's 137 point da 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 da. And he basically said in this lecture, until we understand that number, there won't be any significant progress in physics. So, and everyone was very upset with him because they said, why are you so gloomy and pessimistic? And I think he was way too pessimistic, and I think there were much more important clues than 137. But what I like about Dirac is he was uncompromising. You know, he was uncompromising. People would tell him about all kinds of arcane models to describe this and that, and he would sort of yawn politely and say, you know, not for me. And I think that's a very good attitude. We unfortunately, too few people do that with string theory. But I think more people should say, until you have some real evidence this is on the right track, please don't waste everyone's time with it. Yeah. Let's get somebody else.
So as a scientist, do you think it's more important to just focus all your energy and time on groundbreaking theoretical or experimental research, or actually like have a lot of public outreach and try to improve scientific literacy in the public?
Yeah, I tried to talk about this, that I think both are really important. Obviously, I would like nothing better than to make the next breakthrough, right? And that, it's not so much for myself, I don't really care. I'm not interested in prizes. But for me, it's one of the most magical things about being alive is that we have the potential to understand deep things about nature. So I find that such a privilege to even spend time. I'm totally willing to spend time on it, even if I get nowhere, because it's somehow just respectful of the universe and our role, our place in the universe. But realistically, when I'm being realistic, I recognize that if I help other people think about basic problems, either very theoretical and abstract or practical, that actually my impact will be much, much bigger. And so, both aspects. This is why I'm director of Perimeter. I don't want to be a director. I don't get any kick out of that at all. I don't want to be in charge. What I want is for wonderful things to happen. And you can do it in two ways. You can hide in a corner and find the solution in yourself, or you can help other people to learn and encourage them to pursue really difficult problems and help them when you can. And actually, your impact is much bigger in the second. Just a multiplier effect, because you help them, they help others, you set an example. One thing which is great about theoretical physics is bad in many ways. It's a bad tradition in many ways, excluding women, white male, Caucasian. You know, it's a very narrow discipline. Oxford and Cambridge and all that, Princeton and Harvard, all that crap. Okay, but the good thing about it is the culture in the field of anyone talking to anyone. It's actually really, really good. So you get Stephen Hawking coming to Perimeter. Any graduate student, or come to that, any staff member can come and have a chat with Stephen and say, you know, what about this? I don't quite buy your argument for that. And we just have a culture of accepting questions and that the best ideas will win. So that's a really great thing about theoretical physics. And even though I'm very critical of these big bandwagon fields, what I love about the subject is that we do have common standards as to when something really qualifies as correct. If the math is wrong, we will all agree. I will agree with Alan Guth, you know, your math is wrong, or my math is wrong. We just can't disagree on things like that. And likewise on the observation. The great thing about BICEP is it didn't take long for it to be found out to be wrong. You know, it was 3 months it lasted, and then all went up in smoke. And so that's because it is a really healthy science. So, yeah, I think, you know, in how you decide to spend your life, I mean, trying to have some sort of balance between what you do for yourself and what you do for others is really, really important. It make you, I know when I go to Africa and see what's happening there, and I see people from peasant villages, right, dealing with the most highbrow, sophisticated concepts and being very creative and original, you know, it just blows me away. And I, even though it's very hard work and to keep helping that project, it gives amazing fulfillment. It's nothing like it. Even in research, I don't get such fulfillment. Yeah. I think you had a question.
Oh, yeah. It was actually just about back to the all the theories and the bandwagoning.
Yes.
In your opinion, which theories do you think are on the right track? And if there aren't any that you're particularly keen about, what sort of experimental evidence or experience like going on right now do you think could help to fill in the gaps?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, hi, friends. So, very subjective point of view. There are extremely strong clues that the next principle in physics will be that there is no scale in physics. Okay, so what does that mean? Because physics is about kilograms, meters, seconds, you know, amps, coulombs, whatever. So, actually, coulombs is quite reasonable because it just counts the number of electrons. But meters, lengths, kilograms, newtons, you know, all the other units I've forgotten. What would physics be without any scale? Well, physics would just be about information. So where are the clues that this is probably true? One of the clues is that it seems that the only quantum field theories which make any sense are ones which, when you look at very short distances or very high energies, have no scale. One example is quantum chromodynamics. It's what people call a perfect theory. When you go to very high energies, the quarks and the gluons are just free particles, and they're massless, and the theory has no scale. When you look at gravity, it's very different, because gravity has Newton's constant. Or the Planck mass, when we consider quantum gravity, it becomes the Planck mass. And that's an intrinsic scale, and string theory has a scale, which is the string mass, the mass per unit length of a piece of string, fundamental string. Those theories are problematic. The biggest clue we have is the Big Bang singularity. So Big Bang singularity tells you that the size of the universe was zero, right? And so as soon as you try to tackle that in a theory with a scale, you run into terrible logical contradictions. You only have one point in space. You can't even write down a differential equation because you need to difference 2 points. Okay, you only have one point, you can't get started. There's nothing you can write down. You say, I have a point. So string theory and general relativity fail to tackle this problem of the initial singularity. What we have shown in our work is that if you study theories without a scale, when you go back to the Big Bang singularity, the stuff in the universe doesn't know that, because it doesn't know about the size of the universe at all. So it keeps going no matter what the size is, even if it's zero. And this is what our recent paper does. It shows that when you combine quantum mechanics with a theory without a scale, then you can describe the passage of the universe through a Big Bang singularity. I think it's, in my view, that's the other thing is observationally, when we look at the structure in the universe, the density of matter coming out of the Big Bang had these fluctuations. Turns out they are scale-free, meaning that if I look on any scale, I'll find the density varies by one part in 100,000. Whether it's centimeters or meters or kilometers or light years, it's always one part in 100,000. So it's almost perfectly scale-free. That's another direct observational clue. Whatever happened at the Big Bang had no scale. Okay, and so nature is just telling us it has no scale. Okay. Our problem is that we're not very good at writing down theories without a scale. When we try to write down gravity, we keep introducing the Newton constant. Even Einstein couldn't get away from that. And people have been trying for 100 years. Hermann Weyl, a mathematician, tried to write down a theory which didn't have a scale for gravity. And we're still elaborating those ideas. So yeah, I think that will be the next principle. You know, relativity was all about saying there's no preferred time and there's no preferred space. You mix up space and time in relativity. And I think the next big advance will be when there's no preferred scale. It's almost true in the standard model of particle physics that there's no scale. You write down the Lagrangian, somebody has it on his t-shirt. The all-known physics equation, right? Every term in there except one has no scale. Let me see. No, I'm wrong. There's gravity has one. Gravity has. You can sort of fix that. And then there's a V of phi. And the V of phi, the Higgs potential, yes, hides a multitude of sins. One of which is a parameter fixing the mass of the Higgs boson. That's a scale. And the other one fixes the vacuum energy, the dark energy density. So these two numbers sneak in. And everything else actually has no scale. Maxwell's theory has no scale. Dirac's theory has no scale. Yukawa's theory has no scale. So we've got an abundance of clues. It's just we're being dumb. Okay? We need to recognize that. Okay.
I think we are out of time.
Okay.
So let's, on behalf of ISWP, let's give Neil a thanks.
Thank you.